You're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and this is Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a monthly program of author interviews and book reviews with a local perspective. And I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Today, we're going to be talking to Julie Christine Johnson. She's the author of a brand new book. It's coming out this month. It's called The Crows of Berra. It's set in Ireland, and I could not put it down once I picked it up. So I'm excited to talk to Julie. Actually, we talked about a year and a half ago on the publication of her first book, In Another Life. It was published, I think, in February of 2016. It got a starred review in Library Journal, and that's not an easy thing to have happen. This book is alike in the way that it completely captures you. It's got a strong sense of place. Julie is well-traveled. She's gone all over the world, France and Ireland, New Zealand, and her character seemed to be always leaving Seattle. And one more thing is that Julie is a resident of Port Townsend now, and you'll find her often at Anna Quinn's writing workshop, where she teaches writing, and all over the Puget Sound, she's getting quite a reputation as a writing teacher, and we are so lucky to have her here today. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's delightful to be here.
So I'd like to begin today with you reading just the beginning of your novel so people get a sense of what it is all about.
The Berra Peninsula, Southwest Ireland, March 2012. It is that nervous time between seasons when chill winds skirr across faces upturned to the sun. Light spills over the eastern hills and dives into the valley, sparkles on the western bays. Two small crows reach with red feet and alight on the hag. They dance along her spine with measured, delicate steps to the music of instinct. As one creature, the birds lift their heads to the bay and slice the air with their scimitar beaks. They affirm an unspoken request with an echoing "cur, cur," before swooping up and careering off air currents that take them south and west to their fragile home in Ballycarrig Cove. The crows leave behind the hag, her sightless stone eyes fixed on a point far across Coola Bay, where the silver-blue water roils across rocks and slips into the Atlantic. Her chiseled profile shows a long, straight nose falling from the soft curve of her brow. Gray hair streams behind her, caught in the forever wind that scours the small promontory, beating the grass down to a nubby carpet. Of her seven lives, she has been captured here in her prime, a woman full and complete, defiant in her solitude as she waits endlessly, some say for her husband, others for mercy that will return her stone body to flesh and blood. Many travel far to lay a hand on the blade of her back, leaving tokens of gratitude or supplications at her feet, tokens that fade or are torn apart by the rain and carried away on the wind. Still others are born with the soul of the hag, she who is the essence of Ireland, and carry her spirit into the world, seeking out those in need of her wisdom and lifting them to grace.
A sculpture or a statue of the hag, a woman, and some birds, the red-billed chuff.
Red-billed chuff. Yes.
And it's a relative in the crow family. Mm-hmm. And so this is the first page, and we are not introduced to the human characters, but we are introduced to what's really making this book kind of come together, what brings the characters mm-hmm. together. So tell me how you were inspired or how you found out. Is this about this place? Mm-hmm. Is this a real statue? and also the story about the birds. I have a lot to ask you.
The hag is real. She's actually a stone mm-hmm. that is thousands of years old, and it's not the actual what the stone is made of doesn't bear any relationship to any of the topography around it. Mm-hmm. And it is the profile. When you look at her, the profile is the shape of a woman.
Oh, so it's a natural stone. But it's not a stone that looks like it was naturally there. So exactly. Someone brought it there thousands of years
ago. It's very near an ancient church. And it has become a touchstone and has become a pilgrimage site that takes the legend of the Hag of Barra, which is a legend of a goddess, a deity that is found throughout Scotland, the west coast of Ireland, down into England. And it is a deity who has, in certain parts, associations with water, associations with weather. In this particular part of Ireland, the legend of the hag is that as a young woman, she was turned to stone by a priest. And she has become the symbol of Ireland in its strength and its defiance, in its very feminine qualities of nature. And there's been multitudes of legends and poetry written about her. And I worked one of those poems and worked the legend of this woman who represents a country and truly the spirit of this particular place into the novel.
So it's a strong, mystical presence of a woman of seven ages. And I've never heard of this before because I haven't been to this part of Ireland. And so how did you find out about her? Did you go there?
I first went to the Barra Peninsula, my very first trip to Ireland in 2002. Mm-hmm. And I had gone there knowing nothing of the region. I went hiking. I found a company that would sort of drop you off and pick you up. And so I embarked alone. And I knew nothing about the hag and actually did not encounter her during that trip, but fell completely in love with Ireland and in particular with the Barra Peninsula. When I, many years later in 2014, sat down to write this book, I knew I wanted it to be set in Ireland. I didn't know where. I knew I wanted to weave some sort of Irish legend into a contemporary narrative. I didn't know what. And in the course of researching Irish legends, I came upon the poetry of Leanne O'Sullivan, who is a young poet. She's in her mid to late 30s now and grew up in this area, right on the Barra Peninsula, very near where the book is set. And she has a book of poetry called An Cailleach Barra, which is the Hag of Barra.
Okay. And her name again
is Leanne.
O'Sullivan.
O'Sullivan.
Yes. And her book of poetry is called The Hag of Barra, because I know our listeners are going to want to find out about this.
She's extraordinary. And she also wrote another book of poetry called The Mining Road, which is about the copper mining industry in this area at the end of the 19th century. And I discovered both of these volumes virtually at the same time. And it was just miraculous. It gave me my legend. It gave me a setting where I had been and knew intimately. And it gave me a story problem to work on. What if mining came back in the 1860s, not long after the famine decimated the population, the mining industry also died. And it hasn't been brought back, but that became my door into the story. What if there was a possibility that in this region of economic need, an industry came in that was revived, that had been spent?
A place where people love to mm-hmm. come and hike along the coast and see the untouched Ireland, mm-hmm. but yet a place of poverty, and a place that needs jobs, especially since the Great Depression recession of 2009, when everything seemed to fall apart in Ireland. So here we are, an environmental problem that just seems prevalent all over our country and so many places that we know about. And we've got the bird again. Your character, however, is an American, a young woman named Annie Crow with an E. And how does she find her way into this place? She's not coming as a tourist. Tell us a little bit about that.
Annie is has been in public relations, in strategic communication is the more current term for it, for several years. And she is at a crisis point in her life. She has recently come out of rehab for substance abuse, for alcohol addiction, and has just summarily messed up pretty much everything in her life, her marriage. Her job is on the edge. And she has specialized in sort of addressing environmental issues in the context of corporation and how can we bring communities together with business needs.
Oh, tell them the one that she was so successful with.
She was very successful with the Seattle Viaduct. I'm so sorry.
I thought that was a great piece of realism for us here.
But she is given this assignment. The corporation in Ireland that's looking at the mining is an American-Irish entity, and they have come to this firm in Seattle to get some help in getting their message out to the local community in Ireland that this would benefit their economy and that they can mitigate the environmental damage mm-hmm. that it may do. And this becomes Annie's last-ditch effort to sort of save herself, save her career. If she can get this right, then maybe she can, you know, move on and let go of the past. So she's sent there diving in without really believing what she's doing mm-hmm. and goes there with a great deal of ambivalence and sort of faces her conscience and faces the reality of the mess she's left behind and the one she's got mm-hmm. in front of her.
I do want to say that, you know, sometimes when I read books with characters like this that are very flawed and are really in trouble, I don't like them very much. But I immediately liked Annie, and I was rooting for her. And so I think this is very interesting because the reader is going to be wanting Annie to succeed in convincing the people of the town that, you know, that they can have their cake and eat it too, so to speak. And then, of course, you introduce us to the villagers and the people in the town. And we, the reader, immediately, and especially our Port Townsend readers, will immediately connect with Daniel Savage, who is an artist and who makes money by taking people on hiking adventures along the Barrow Way and the Kerry Way and these places that come alive to us in your book. And also the folk in the town that decide, well, we better get together a coalition and we're going to fight the big multinational. So congratulations on that. There's some other characters, too, that we're not so fond of. But you bring them pretty much alive. I was going to ask you, I know that you've traveled. I know that you live in Port Townsend, so you know what it's like to live on the coast and what it's like to have work against and protecting the environment against the people that want to destroy the environment around us. But what about how did you bring these corporate multinationals so alive? Not only her boss in Seattle, but the men that she ran into and that she was working with. Have you had much experience there?
You know, it's so funny. Someone pointed out in a review a couple of days ago that I managed to sort of bring alive the condescension and patronizing attitude that can happen around a corporate table mm-hmm. and I don't think I actively sought to do that, but it came out somehow. I was a very, very young woman when I did my master's degree and entered higher education as a professional field. And certainly there were times in staff meetings, in faculty meetings, where it wasn't just my gender, it was my age, and the combination of the two made for some interesting encounters mm-hmm. with folks who were older and of perhaps not my gender. So we'll let it go with that.
Oh, the professor class, right.
You know, but what was happening, I mean, in terms of the multinational aspect of this, I had worked that in earlier drafts, but as I was going through revisions with the publisher, there were some ripped from the headlines incidents with Apple and Google in particular, in mm-hmm. Ireland specifically, mm-hmm. that dealt with these shell corporations and dealt with really shady behavior that that took advantage and ran with the way that Ireland has set up its foreign tax systems and the way that, that you can be sheltered there.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole concept of double Irish that, that happens towards the end of the book, that, that was happening in real time as I was working in the latter part of the revision. So it was a coup for me.
Right.
And it was fascinating to be able to just kind of dovetail that right into the narrative.
As I was reading that, I thought, wow, you know a lot about this aspect of the story as well, mm-hmm. about, you know, how they were able to just basically con everyone in Ireland and not even really go through mm-hmm. the process of the hearings. And I know that a lot of us are feeling that, too, that, you know, when you try to have a grassroots environmental coalition that's working for the protection, whether it be a plant or a coast or an animal, sometimes we feel like the deck is already stacked. Mm-hmm. Now, there have been some successes, so I'm not going to say that it's not possible, but right now it seems so hard. And so this book, even though, you know, you're kind of going back in history, and it's a very romantic story, and it's very human. There's also these right now themes that we're dealing with in politics, in our country, and around the world. So congratulations to you. It really grabs you in a lot of ways. Let's go back to another kind of interwoven part, the copper mine and the copper artist. That was great. Tell us about Daniel and his art, because I, you know, knowing you, you didn't just make up this copper etching in abstract and putting the patinas on. How did you research that and find out about his art?
Did you? That just was one of those things that you sort of magically pull from the air. I knew nothing about copper art. And of course, we're surrounded by such amazing artists here. Mm-hmm. And what a joy to be in this community where artists are so accessible and so welcome to show you how they go about making their craft. And Daniel is coming into the story with demons of his own. And both he and Annie share addiction to alcohol and recovery and some horrible mistakes that were made because of the choices that they've made and other people in their lives. So they are both coming into it with a need to create sort of out of the ashes of their lives. And Daniel is much further along in his creative potential and exploring his art than Annie. And he has become a copper artist. And the irony, of course, being that he's taking from the land something that is now threatening the very livelihood and integrity of this beautiful place. But Daniel uses recycled copper. Mm-hmm. exclusively, and that becomes an interesting conversation in the book as he sort of realizes, as someone who doesn't want to join this fight, he wants to stay out of it, he just wants to live his life and make his art and be a guide and keep out of the fray. And at a certain point he realizes, I'm in it already, and what I can give is my art. And there's a conversation that I love that I actually had with someone as I was writing the book about nature as a cultural artifact and how art, even art that isn't meant to be political in nature, can become political because of the materials used and because of what it represents and what it can show us. And even in the beauty, we're exposing people to their environment and saying, this is what we're trying to preserve. And so in his realization, and it's happened to me very much, particularly this year, as a writer, what is mine to do? And what is my responsibility in speaking out and in protesting and resisting, and how, what do I have to give? Mm-hmm. And what am I just naturally giving? I don't have a choice in some way. This is my sword. This is my act of resistance, is continuing to create. And Daniel has that moment when he realizes I'm already in it.
Mm-hmm. You're in his studio. And seeing him work, and that was really great because you could really sense his process and see his tools and see where he hurts himself. And speaking of hurting themselves, they're not only emotionally in trouble, but these two, especially Annie, seems to have a lot of physical problems as well. So this is the part where I'm kind of like, is Daniel going to come save her again? And he does. What is about Annie and her, and they're not pratfalls. She has some, she almost gets run over. She has a fall. She begins the story with, you know, her career as a runner, as a potential Olympic runner, ending because she falls. Why did you decide to make her a runner and have these near devastating accidents?
Poor Annie.
Oh, I know, poor
she's
Annie.
So wounded. You know, I think maybe the author was inserting some of her own woes into
the author. That's you.
A former runner, which fortunately I did not have quite the experience Annie did, but having been a longtime runner, and so that felt very natural to me to be able to move in her body, and particularly the scene on the beach where she's just sort of pounding out her frustrations and encounters the birds in a moment of deep peace and serenity. So that aspect of a runner was something that was very much a part of my life. And I don't run anymore. Injury. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. So going through that process with her of giving up something that for her was far more serious than it ever was for me. But where do you put that energy? What do you become when your identity is so aligned with your very body and what people see you as being? And that's just in an instant gone. And who do you become? And so she became something that probably wasn't a good fit for her, but it was a hand that was held out at a time when someone saw something in her, and she carried on for a long time and became a person that was doing things that didn't fit her belief system. But you get into that habit and you just keep going.
She's living in Seattle and making a lot of money.
That's right.
You are listening to Book Lovers Cafe. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and we're talking to Julie Christine Johnson about her new book, The Crows of Bera. Let's talk about the magic in this, and more, go back to the hag and her seven lives. You work that into the story, but very lightly. We're not time traveling in this book. It just seems like various aspects of this feminine power appear to kind of just guide Annie or just touch her in a way. So tell us about those characters and how you wove them into the story.
I don't know that I could have written a story about Ireland that didn't have some sort of mystical quality to it, right? It seems like a cliche, but it's so natural. Mm-hmm. The hag in this particular version of the legend has seven lives that represent the seven different stages of a woman's life, from young woman, child, to old crone. And Annie meets various incarnations of these women in the characters who are themselves very contemporary and very normal, except for perhaps one of them, who become mentors and guides and even in a moment encounter that reach her and sort of teach her, even if she's not recognizing it at the moment. And that happened not by plan or outline. It just seemed to naturally happen within the story. Mm-hmm. Some of them take on much greater importance in the story than the others, but in the end, they all become the thing that sort of draws her into this complete circle of that experience and gives her pause and gives her reason to think that perhaps she has something else to do with her life. Perhaps she has someone else that she needs to be beyond her identity as an addict, beyond her identity as a runner, beyond her identity as a failure in this present.
I loved B, the older, the wise hag at the AA meeting, who said, you know, the old woman is going to beat the addict any day. That's my own interpretation of what she said. There's an art gallery owner, Magritte, who describes Annie. I'm going to just read that quote because I just thought that was really well written. And here it is. There's something alive in her, trying so hard to break through. The woman is like an uncertain moth, searching for her creativity, like a flame to send her into flight. That's the kind of words that you're going to read when you're reading Julie's work. There's, I'm going to mention some of the incarnations. There's a woman, the cat goddess in green with the cat eye glasses, and in blue, the Gaelic speaking girl, the sister of Daniel who died. There's the whispering voice that they both hear. Do they ever discover that they both hear the whispering, soaring voice?
Okay. Yep. In a moment of great tension where she's denying that she's hearing this, and Daniel's far more open to that shared possibility.
Yes, it's not an easy coming together of these two, that's for sure. If you like historical novels, I'm thinking about Chocolat, and because it's in France, and you wrote so well about being in France. And sometimes I think about when I read your book, Sarah Addison Allen, but I think you have a little bit more depth, actually, than she does. We're a local radio, we can say that. Alice Hoffman. Somewhere in between that and Isabel Allende, you know, it's just, I'm really looking forward to seeing what you're going to write next. Have you got some things in mind?
I have a novel on submission now, which has absolutely no fantasy or magical realism in it at all, but it's set in New Zealand, and it's about an American woman who opens a bakery in a small town on the South Island, and encounters a young girl there. Her next-door neighbor is a Maori woman and her child, and their circumstances are pretty dire, and the young girl disappears. And so my character, Holly, goes in search of her and learns a little bit about cultural nuances and injecting herself into situations that she doesn't understand, well-meaning, but not with the best of circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
No
don't say too much. Okay, so we're going to a completely different place. And hopefully you're going to be staying here based in Port Townsend. Maybe someday you'll write something that's set on the Olympic Peninsula.
My next work, the book I'm working on now, is set partly here and closer to the Olympic rainforest. But yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's what I that's what I thought. Probably somewhere in the woods. Somewhere in the woods. So we've been talking today to Julie Christine Johnson, and I really enjoyed chatting with you and hope to talk to you again. Join us next time for more books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. You can listen to past shows and other programs direct from the KPTZ podcast page on the website at kptz.org. You can make a donation to the station as well, anytime. We're a completely listener-sponsored radio here. I'd like to thank Pat Rogers for working on the website, for Kate Ingram, who is trying to herd all the cats, and Mike Slexer, who's in the booth and edits and engineers this program. This radio station is a really wonderful place to be, and join me next time for more books and more music if you listened after the show. See you later. Bye.